Okay, folks, can everyone hear me? The most observant amongst you will realise that I'm not actually Christopher Coker, the head of the International Relations Department. He sends his apologies. He's unable to make it at the last minute because of a personal thing that he had to attend to. But he did ask me to convey his warmest welcome to all people participating in the symposium today. I'm Kimberly Hutchings. I'm a professor in the International Relations Department here at the LSC, and I'm involved in various parts of the programme, but I've always been quite closely involved with Elizabeth Stubbins Bates as our David Davis of Lamdenum Fellow this year, and she, as you know, has been the organiser and has taken sole responsibility for getting this event up and running. I won't speak for long, but I'd just like to say a few things in welcome and to put the symposium, the conference, in context. First of all, on behalf of the International Relations Department and of the school, I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to all of the participants in the conference, in particular to those who've come some distance to be here, and in particular also to everybody who has agreed to speak at the conference. I know many people have taken time out from very busy lives in order to contribute. In terms of sort of situating this conference, I think it is firmly in several traditions that are relevant to today. First of all, it's very firmly in the tradition of the school, which has always wanted to link academic research agendas to issues of political, legal, and ethical significance. And I think it would be hard to find any issue of greater political, legal, and ethical significance than the arbitrary detention and rendition of people. Secondly, I would suggest the conference is very much in the tradition of the International Relations Department at the LSE, which now for over 80 years has been, amongst other things, seeking to investigate and interrogate the role of norms and values in international society and in international politics more generally. But third, and perhaps most important for this conference in particular, I would suggest that it's very much in the tradition pioneered by thinkers and activists like David Davis, who in the earlier part of the 20th century fought for standards of justice to be translated into international politics and international law. This symposium has been organised by the first International Relations Department David Davis of Lamdenum Research Fellow, Elizabeth Stubbins Bates, and it is inspired precisely by the goal of bringing together academic, policy, and activist communities to address a very stark and pressing issue for international human rights and international humanitarianism. We're very grateful to the Deanham Charity who endowed the fellowship, and I'm delighted that Mandy Cormack is able to be with us today, one of the trustees. And even more grateful, I think, to our first David Davis Lamdenum Fellow, who's made a wonderful start to the fellowship by organising this conference, by making today possible. So on that note, I think I just wish to wish you all a very interesting, exciting, and productive day. Thank you. But as we have three speakers, I think it makes sense for us to get stuck in straight away. I'll start sending notes if you go on for too long, but sort of 20, 25 minutes. What we thought we would do is we'll take the speakers in sequence so that we then have time for questions at the end of the speakers' presentations. Okay, so I'm delighted to welcome Fiona Londras as our first speaker in this panel, who is speaking on the subject of process-based detention without charge, a legitimate tool in counterterrorism? Yeah.
Thank you very much. The question mark is important, I think. I want to echo Professor Hutchings' thanks to Elizabeth for organising today's conference, which is, as you rightly noted, a collection, I think, of people from lots of cognate disciplines like law. One always feels at an event not organised by a law school that one should begin by apologising for being a lawyer. But there are a number of lawyers here, so I'll skip the apology. But law, international relations, critical terrorism studies and political studies. People who are academics, practitioners and indeed both. And I think that it's a very well-timed event because it strikes me that this is a period of time when a significant amount of political legal space has opened up for us to reflect on how detention in particular might be used as a means of trying to counter terrorism. What I want to do today over the next 20 or 25 minutes is to kind of try to question whether it is possible to design a system of detention without trial, which I may sometimes shortcut as internment, that is legitimate. And in this context, I think two things are important initially. The first thing is that I do not equate legitimacy with lawfulness. In other words, just because something is embedded in a statute or in a legislative process does not necessarily, within the model that I'm going to lay out, mean that it is legitimate. In other words, instead of taking what you might call a narrow rule of law approach, which is just that it's gone through Parliament, I'm taking a broad rule of law approach, so an approach that evokes ideas of rights and democracy and process and deliberation, which are important in creating the model that I wanted to lay out. The second preliminary point is to say that I approach this as a human rights lawyer, and to maybe just note my approach to how human rights and security interact. The predominant literature in law, at least since 2001, has set this up as a contestation between security and rights, what's sometimes known as the security versus rights dichotomy. And essentially, if you go to the extremes of the two levels of this argument, the extreme security level argument would say that terrorism is a distinct challenge to national security, that it is something that the executive level of the state should have control over, and that judges and parliaments should have little or no control or say in how counterterrorism works. And I call that the executive supremacy view. So it is really a view that says that security can and should trump rights, even fundamental rights like the right to be free from torture, for example. Although fewer people have been willing to say that than have been willing to intimate it in what they've written. The other level of the argument, the rights-based level, would say that there is nothing distinctive about terrorism that means that the ordinary criminal processes cannot be used, that there should not be any extraordinary laws, any emergency designation in a legal sense. That could lead to aggrandisement of state powers. I reject both of those positions, and instead I focus on the idea of security and rights as coexisting. And indeed, I would argue that that is the view or the system that is embedded in international human rights law, which allows for the designation of emergency, allows for some rights to be limited, but within very strict frameworks. Okay, so it's not an absolute, it's not the executive supremacy argument, but it's also not the right supremacy argument. And that is the viewpoint from which I approach the question of trying to set up a process-based system of detention without trial. Of course, to do that and to talk about any kind of an approach to terrorism does require one to grapple to some extent with what we mean by terrorism. I'm pleased to say that I don't have time in my paper to go into this in too much detail because it is a minefield of a question. But what I would say is that, in my view, terrorism is in some ways distinct. It is distinct from war, generally, and it is distinct from crime, generally, even though it often, if not always, involves acts that are criminal and sometimes involves warlike behaviours. Now, there is, at the international level, as many of you will know, no really a binding legal definition of terrorism that has general effect. There are some definitions within specific treaties based on freezing finances and so on, but no generally legally binding definition of terrorism. But there is a kind of a consensus non-binding definition of terrorism from the General Assembly, which is here. So you see it has elements of criminality, and the thrust of this definition is to say that these acts have no justification. In other words, this is what seems to distinguish them from criminal acts. There isn't a defence to them. Okay, if you were to be very loy about it, they are absolutely unjustifiable and indefensible acts of criminality. What this definition doesn't do is it doesn't go further in its distinction to separate out different kinds of groups who are often labelled terrorists, but who claim that their action ought not to have the terrorist label. I've just given three examples here in the illustration. The first one is what you might call freedom fighters or liberators. Here we have just two murals from Northern Ireland, a Sinn Féin IRA mural and a UVF mural. The second is people who would self-define as resistance fighters. You have here a picture evoking Palestinian resistance fighters. And the third are state actors who seem to absolutely deny the capacity to be termed terrorists, even though if what they did were not done by a state, we would often never question its terroristic nature. So the international level definition, in as much as it exists, doesn't really grapple with these intricate questions of separating out categories. The difficulty, and the reason I mention the international level, is because without an internationally binding definition of terrorism, domestic definitions of terrorism don't have a reference point in international law. In other words, domestic parliaments can introduce definitions of terrorism that have domestic legal effect that are, in many senses, the definition of a net cast wide in law. They tend to be broad and vague and to include a whole host of people in them. And many times, the people who fit that domestic terrorist label are the people who can be subjected to detention without charge or trial. So that's where the link arises there. I think that Marie might be talking more about what terrorism means or doesn't mean later, but that's as much as I intend to say about it at this stage. What I really want to focus on is the idea of a process-based deprivation of liberty. Now, this reflects the fact that in international human rights law, at least, we don't have a prohibition on deprivation of liberty per se. The prohibition is on arbitrary deprivation of liberty. And in classical terms, we make something non-arbitrary by ensuring that states provide two levels of safeguard. The first level of safeguard is to say that there are limited bases upon which one can be taken in to the state's detention. The classic one, of course, is conviction of a criminal offence and sentencing. But there are others, including in international human rights law, two that are relevant to terrorism. The first is to prevent the commission of a criminal offence, and the second is to prevent people from fleeing the jurisdiction. Both of those are in many ways relevant to the detention of suspected terrorists. The second kind of classical safeguard is to say that there must be procedural safeguards that surround detention. So you have to be brought before a judge promptly, for example. You have to have the capacity or the opportunity to challenge the lawfulness of your detention. Within my model here, I'm classifying those two classical levels of detention, of non-arbitrary safeguards as being meaningful review and non-discrimination. So the two horizontal levels there. By the way, the placement, horizontal or vertical, has no actual relevance. It was very random. Added to that, to those two classical levels, in a situation of detention without charge or trial based on an assumed or perceived or actual terrorism-related crisis, I say we need two more democratic-level safeguards. And these are, in my model, justificatory deliberation and effective temporal limitation. Now, what I'm going to do for most of the paper is to disaggregate these four points and to talk through them and how I think that they might work. But essentially, my argument is that historical cases of internment that have failed have not failed because of internment per se. Rather, they have failed because they were not process-based. Okay, so because they were not legitimate. So in my vision, what is process-based becomes legitimate. Legitimacy there, again, being connected to broad conceptions of the rule of law as opposed to narrow conceptions. So I suppose the classical example of an illegitimate internment or detention without trial system is Operation Demetrius and the preceding detention without trial in Northern Ireland. It went from 1971 to 1975. It was introduced on the basis of this list that Faulkner, who was then the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, had made up of suspected terrorists. And that list was actually found to be not reliable by the British military intelligence before internment was introduced. But it nevertheless was introduced under the Special Powers Act of 1922. So it had a legislative basis. On the first day of Operation Demetrius, 342 people were detained, all of whom were Catholics. Over the course of internment, 1,874 Catholics were interned and 107 Loyalists or Protestants. So there was a clear discriminatory or patent discrimination in the way that Operation Demetrius and the ensuing internment worked. The result of that was to create a most immense backlash. Operation Demetrius is one of the few examples that we use in when we talk about counterterrorism and law to show that repressive measures do not necessarily always aggrandize state powers. In this case, Operation Demetrius was an abject failure in terms of state expansionism because it resulted in increased identification with the IRA, for example. It resulted in a very heavy level of backlash, reduced levels of faith in the state for marginalized communities, and of course it led to civil rights marches, including Bloody Sunday, which was the protest against internment. So here we have an example of a really disastrous detention without trial process. Was it disastrous because it was internment per se, or was it disastrous because it was not process-based? There was very little deliberative justification. The habeas corpus that people were entitled to was extremely shallow. And the European Court of Human Rights simply compounded the difficulty by being incredibly deferential towards the United Kingdom when the internment system came before them in Ireland and the United Kingdom. This system also allowed for the deployment of what were known as the five techniques, five inhuman and degrading techniques of interrogation that were used against the internees who were held either in Crumlin Road Prison in Belfast or in Long Kesh. So my point in pointing very briefly towards internment in Northern Ireland is simply to prick the curiosity in terms of asking whether or not internment as an option was illegitimate, or whether or not internment as it was rolled out was illegitimate in the context of Northern Ireland. So let's move on to the first of my four requirements for process-based internment, detention without trial, and that is deliberative justification. Any time that a government wants to change policy or change law, we expect them to engage in a process of deliberative justification. They make up their policy, maybe a preliminary briefing paper. They go to Parliament. It's discussed. Oftentimes, there are discussions on question time in the newspaper, perhaps in the Security Council. So three levels, I'd say, of justificatory deliberation that are quite normal in states' behaviour. It's reflected here by a picture of a, to be fair, abnormally full House of Commons, the United Nations Security Council, and some newspapers, because I couldn't find a picture of question time. So we should expect the same level of deliberatory justification when it comes to the introduction of a policy, whether it's based in legislation or not, that involves detention without charge or trial. There are a few reasons for this. The first reason is that it is a basic democratic requirement that major legal and policy changes would go through a rigorous justificatory process. Secondly, because there is an important design element here. A lot of the problems that arise with detention without trial systems are design problems. There isn't judicial review, or it doesn't happen fast enough, or the net is cast too wide. If you had a rigorous policy and process of deliberatory justification, it is possible that those design flaws, so to speak, could be ironed out, at least to some extent, within that process. We have the perfect example of that here in the UK, where the House of Lords, acting as a parliamentary body, has ironed out a huge number of design flaws in proposed systems during the war on terrorism, always in inverted commas, but I'm not going to do that every time, during the war on terrorism. So I think that when a state decides to introduce such a system, they must accrue legitimacy by putting it through normal parliamentary processes. This is not to say that there are no problems with those processes. Of course there are. You often have a three-line whip, for example. It's a difficult thing for people to rebel against within Parliament. Popular sentiment is very often in favour of more repressive measures rather than less repressive measures. But from a process perspective and a design perspective, I think it's important that this would happen. What is the objection? Well, the objection that one often hears is that a process of deliberatory justification would tip people off and people could then flee. Okay, so that if you hear Parliament is going to discuss that it plans to intern all people with red hair, if you have red hair, you're probably going to leave, right, as soon as you can. This, in my view, is a difficulty, sure, but it's not insurmountable. So there are lots of ways that you could try to ameliorate that difficulty. Like you might create a preliminary watch list and give law enforcement capacity to surveil the people on that watch list closely, for example, during the process of justificatory deliberation. Again, that's not problem-free. Certainly it could have privacy implications, but a privacy deprivation is arguably less gross a deprivation than a liberty deprivation. So I think that it can iron out. And my point here is not to try to design a superstructure of how you would counteract these difficulties, but merely to say that difficulties around security that are mooted as arguments against rigorous deliberative justification are not insurmountable. They can be countered through, I suppose, imaginative processes. The second requirement is the requirement of non-discrimination. Again, non-discrimination here counts and feeds into legitimacy in a very important way. When I say that the policy should be non-discriminatory, what I mean is that one should never be subjected to that policy on the basis of ascribed or assumed characteristics, but always on the basis of an individual risk assessment. Now, this means that you have to be wary of discrimination coming into the system at two important points. The first way I think it can come in is as a built-in discrimination at the point of design. The second way is as a creeping-in discrimination at the point of application. So the two pictures here are designed to, or intended to evoke that. The first one is from a BBC News report of a protest against detention in Belmarsh Prison. Belmarsh equals UK's Guantanamo. The Belmarsh Prison detention, as you probably know, arose from Part 4 of the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act of 2001, which was subsequently found incompatible with the Human Rights Act by the House of Lords in A and the Secretary of State. But the way in which this was discriminatory is that Part 4 expressly said that the capacity to certify someone and have them detained without charge or trial on the basis of terrorist or suspected terrorist involvement was limited to non-UK citizens. The House of Lords held that there was actually no objective justification for limiting it in that way. And unfortunately, the attacks on the London Underground showed that there was, in fact, a clear risk from the UK citizenry itself in terms of terrorism and terroristic activity. So you have to be careful at the design level. And again, justificatory deliberation can help, I think, to try to iron out design flaws. The second level is in the application of it. And the illustration here shows poor Santa Claus being subjected to a very crude, clearly racially motivated checklist at an airport based on hair covering, he's wearing a hat, facial hair, he has a beard, and what the guard calls funny clothes. And based on all of those three crude assessments, Santa Claus is deemed a risk, a threat, and taken into security, even though those of us who know Santa Claus know that he has no terroristic tendencies whatsoever. So there is, that is, I suppose, a comic illustration of the crudeness of discrimination at the application level, but also an illustration of how easily discrimination can creep in at the application level. So you have to be careful both in design and in application. The third requirement is meaningful processes, and this is where the lawyer in me perhaps would come out. By meaningful processes, I have identified here four elements that are important: access to a court or equivalent, access to the evidence against you, effective legal representation, and a meaningful opportunity for release. And I want to just talk briefly about all four of them. What I mean here, first of all, is that if somebody is taken in to the state's detention under a system of detention without charge or trial, that they ought to have access to meaningful processes. And those meaningful processes need to have those four elements to them. And I've drawn those four elements from international human rights law. So we talk first of all about the court or equivalent. It doesn't have to be a court, okay, in the conventional sense. What we do need is to ensure that you can argue that your detention is not lawful before a body that has the characteristics of a court. So it should be objective, it should be independent, should be really steeped in a tradition of liberal constitutionalism in as much as possible. Some argue that this role ought never to be carried out by a court because courts don't have the expertise to deal with questions of security. My counter-argument to that is that courts don't have expertise in tax either, or in medical decisions, or in the environment. What courts have expertise in is the application of legal standards to particular fact scenarios. You're not asking courts to do anything different here than they do every single day. So I don't think that the expertise argument is a viable one. The second element to meaningful process is that you must have access to evidence. It is practically impossible for somebody to make an effective argument against their detention if they do not know the grounds upon which they have been detained. So the evidence must be released. Sometimes there may be security concerns about some parts of the evidence. Again, those concerns are not insurmountable. You might make them, that part of the evidence available to one's legal counsel, but not to the person themselves. You might even have a pool of specialist legal counsel retained in order to deal with that kind of evidence. There are ways that you can counteract those difficulties. Your legal representation must be effective, however, and that means you have to be able to meet with counsel and to discuss your case openly and without eavesdropping with legal counsel. Sometimes your legal representation will be a special advocate or something like that because of the sensitivity of the evidence. But special advocates can work very well. In fact, in Northern Ireland, in many ways, it was the professionalism and the liberalism of the legal professionals who acted in the Diplock courts that made the Diplock courts work in as much as they worked, and actually over time liberalised Diplock courts. The final element there is a meaningful opportunity for release. All the habeas corpus petitions in the world won't be meaningful if you can't actually be released afterwards. The court has to be able to order release. And we've seen in Guantanamo Bay that that has been incredibly difficult, even where somebody has been found not to be an unlawful enemy combatant, it's been very hard for them to secure release. The final requirement is that of temporal limitation. We have here a picture of Julius Caesar. He wasn't actually made of wood. This is clearly a wood carving of Julius Caesar. But Caesar was the last of the classical Roman military dictators. In the classical Roman Republic, it was possible for the Senate to declare a six-month emergency and create within that emergency a military dictator. The dictator had no capacity himself to extend that period of time. But Caesar, as an effective political agent, managed to have himself deemed dictator in perpetuity. And 2 years later, because of the tyrannical nature with which he used his position as dictator in perpetuity, he was killed by an estimated 60 people in the Campus Martius. Now, my point here is not to say that any emergency should not last beyond 6 months, but rather to just evoke for you the dangers that are inherent in allowing emergencies or emergency regimes such as internment to go on without some kind of time limit or braking system that's introduced. There are two possible approaches, the stopwatch and sunset clauses. Stopwatches are very tricky because in reality, you can't say that an emergency lasts for 6 months anymore. In the Roman Republic, you could because 6 months was the length of a military year. Okay? Stopwatches can be useful, though, in terms of saying that the moment you detain someone, the stopwatch starts to the point of time which you have to bring them before a judge. Okay? So you can use a stopwatch in that way. Sunset clauses are clauses put into legislation that say that this legislation will be exhausted after a certain period of time unless it is renewed by Parliament. Sunset clauses do get used, but they don't work very well. And they don't work very well because they inevitably result either in nobody turning up for the vote, and the vote becomes a damp squib. So everyone fights for the sunset clause at first when it's, you know, politically exciting and sexy and in the papers, but 13 months later nobody turns up to vote on the sunset clause. Or everyone turns up and a three-line whip is imposed and the government carries the vote without very much difficulty. Sunset clauses, in my view, can only lend legitimacy to a system if they are accompanied by a free vote in Parliament. I think that that's very important. So if you had those four, if you take those four levels of process-based design. How does Guantanamo Bay shape up? Not too well, unsurprisingly enough. First of all, no justificatory deliberation. The president was given an authority to by Congress to counter the perceived terrorist threat, and he decided that detention would happen in Guantanamo Bay. Secondly, there was no meaningful review for a long time. Because Guantanamo Bay is located outside of the mainland United States, the administration argued that the federal courts had no jurisdiction over it, even when the Supreme Court said in the case of Razul in 2004 that there was jurisdiction on a statutory basis. Congress then made the combatant status review tribunals, so very process deficient tribunals, the basis for review. Or the location of review. It's been incredibly discriminatory so far. Only non-US citizen Muslims and males, I think, have been detained in Guantanamo. I'm open to correction on whether a woman has been detained there, have been detained in Guantanamo Bay. And indeed, it was the Supreme Court last year in the Boumediene case that finally held that constitutionally people detained in Guantanamo Bay must have access to federal courts. There are still problems with that. I'm aware that I'm running out of time. What does that say? Time
stop.
Stop. Okay. I will stop in just a second. The legacy of illegitimacy is that President Obama is left with three stark choices. You can release Moazem Begg as the example there. You can try someone, Al-Mari is the example there, who after years in detention was finally moved into a federal prison and pleaded guilty to one charge of conspiracy last Thursday. Or you have continuing detention, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the example there. My view is that the only way that that third option of indefinite detention without trial, potentially forever, arises is where you have process deficient, illegitimate detention without trial in the first place. If, on the other hand, you have a process-based system, it is highly unlikely, I think, that you would ever, in fact, have a situation of indefinite detention without trial. Thank you. Sorry for going over.
That's fine. Thank you very much. Marie. Our next speaker is Marie Smythe, who is speaking on Critical Terrorism Studies, Terrorism and Counterterrorism, and there's a subtitle as well, but I've lost it.
Yeah, and I'm about to lose it as well, but never mind.
It's probably changed since it went to the programme.
Okay. No, I was actually asked to speak about Critical Terrorism Studies and Suspect Communities, and I always do as I'm told. If I could just find my... Okay, I'm going to start with an apology because this time tomorrow I will be addressing an audience in Helsinki. And so that requires me to leave pretty promptly after I finish speaking. I will be able to stay for the coffee break, but then I'm leaving. So if you have comments, abusive or otherwise, to pass to me, and you don't manage to get me here, my email address is here, and I welcome hearing from you. I also want to start by giving a kind of number of health warnings about what I'm about to say. I'm part of a team in Aberystwyth in the Centre for the Study of Radicalisation and Contemporary Political Violence, and we avoid using the T word for reasons which I think the scare marks that were indicated by my colleague speak to. We advocate a critical examination of much of the received knowledge, wisdom and scholarship on terrorism. That is not to say, first and foremost, this is a first health warning, that we do not consider terrorism to be a problem. I am, as you can tell from my accent, not from the south of England. I'm from Northern Ireland. I was 16 when the Troubles broke out in Northern Ireland, and I lived most of my adult life under the continuing presence of non-state violence aimed at killing people, and it's not a pleasant thought, and I am very well aware of that. I was 20 when I first came under sniper fire. I was 21 when my life was threatened by an illegal organisation in Northern Ireland, and on and on. So I'm very well aware of the problem that terrorism poses. However, I also have problems with the way terrorism is understood, and I will be speaking to that today. The second thing is, I'm not at all going to list names of people who have written about terrorism and denounce them. That's not what this is about. I think I myself have changed my views, and I think will probably continue to change my views, but I think there are some problems extant in the writing about terrorism, and I'm advocating that all of us look a little bit more critically at the topic, including myself. The third health warning is a slightly more serious one, and that is that I am departing from normal academic practice in that I intend to use my personal experience of living as a person in a community as data for my argument. And so I will be speaking about my own experience as well as the experience of other people in the presentation. And finally, I'm going to use some images from the past, from Northern Ireland, but also from in the present climate of what I consider to be Islamophobia. Some of those images are offensive, and I use them not to offend people, but to illustrate the nature of the problem. Okay, having said all that, I'll now start talking, presenting the presentation. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about dominant ideas about terrorism and the critical turn in terrorism studies that we're advocating. Then I want to turn to the ideas of Paddy Hilliard, who was the first person to talk about the suspect community. And I want to use Paddy's ideas and redefine them somewhat to make an argument about what a suspect community, in my understanding, is. I want to deploy certain concepts there, and I'll not bore you with them now, I'll bore you with them later. I want to then talk a little bit about suspects, politics, and national security, and I want to talk about the security of suspect communities and what makes suspects secure. And finally, I want to finish by referring to the topic of rendition, which is what we're here to talk about. So I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on rendition per se, or abduction, or kidnap, if you want to call it by those alternative terms. I leave that to the rest of the speakers. I'm going to talk about what I was told to talk about. So first of all, if we look at the literature on terrorism, it seems, and I'm not the only one to point this out, Orthodox scholars also refer to some of the problems extant in the literature. People who write about terrorism and study it exist in a world which has very strongly held views about terrorism itself. The newspapers, the tabloid press are full of accounts of terrorism, and certain commonplaces prevail about terrorism. So we're writing in a climate and are influenced by a climate in which, for example, the risk of terrorism is, in my view, inflated. I, as I've said, lived in Northern Ireland, and nonetheless, all of the time that I lived in Northern Ireland, during the 35 years of conflict there, the risk to my life was greater from death in a car accident than it was from terrorism. And that was true right throughout the whole period. Yet that is not something that is represented in either the policy or the scholarship very often about terrorism. And of course, we would go out of business, wouldn't we, if we made too much of a meal of it. Secondly, as Fiona has said, there is no agreed definition of what terrorism actually is, which makes for very muddied conversations. And one thing, you may be talking about one thing when you talk about terrorism, and I might be talking about something else. And of course, the big difficulty is including or finding a definition that will cover terrorism as a method which can be used by a number of actors, including state actors, as again Fiona has mentioned. Thirdly, I think this notion of security that we talk about is very often taken for granted also. And quite often when you read the accounts about terrorism, the notion of state security is put forward. And yet, I think there is a problem about assuming that security is only the security of the state. And in fact, my colleague in Aberystwyth, Ken Booth, has put forward an alternative critical security dimension and argued that, in fact, the ultimate referent of security ought not to be the state, it ought to be the individual. And yet, in the consideration of the problem that terrorism is, the state is seen to be the one that is endangered, whereas arguably the individual is a more suitable referent. The other problem about a lot of what's written about terrorism is that it's a political normative too. Nobody queues up at the desk to be called a terrorist. It's a pejorative term, and it's used to delegitimise, for example, effective resistance to oppressive regimes. And amongst former terrorists, we can name people like Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, and so on and so forth. So it's a term used to delegitimise, and that in itself has become a problem. And of course, the delegitimisation of these movements or groups justifies extraordinary measures. And I am greatly concerned, as many people are, of what we will discover in the months and years to come of what has gone on in the battle against the terrorist group, the LTTE, in Sri Lanka, when journalists are finally allowed in to the villages to discover what counter-terrorist measures have been used there. The other problem in the literature is, or another problem in the literature, is the use of the term new terrorism. And the new terrorism, following David Rappaport's idea of there being four waves of terrorism, refers to post-2001 9/11 developments. And the argument about new terrorism being more religiously motivated, for example, being more global in nature, being more targeted at civilians and so on, is very often used to discount lessons that we might learn from the past. And I think that, for us, is a problem. The emphasis on religious aspects, for example, makes the argument quite often that religiously motivated terrorists are more ruthless, and therefore it's a waste of time even thinking about negotiating with them. And I think that is a problem in itself, and in terms of arguing for more physical force responses, which arguably lessons from the past would indicate are less effective and are likely to escalate rather than solve the problem. Also, and I referred to this earlier, terrorism is in the literature quite often assumed to be the prerogative of non-state actors rather than state actors. And we have three possibilities for states being involved in terrorism: direct action, the bombing of civilians, for example. We also have the support of groups acting, such as the United States involvement in some of the Latin American countries, supporting non-state actors to overthrow democratic regimes there. Or you have the third option, which has been the practice of the British government in Northern Ireland, to support proxies in the form of terrorist groups or non-state actors in the loyalist side of the fence. And that leading to the current debate about allegations of collusion between the security forces in Northern Ireland and loyalist paramilitaries. So states do get involved in terrorism, and yet that is not something that has, until relatively recently, been clear in some of the terrorist literature. I've referred to risk inflation, and I won't go over that again, but it does seem that for all sorts of reasons to do with partly public opinion and the kind of moral panic that there is about terrorism, that the risk of terrorism is presented as, in my view and the view of many others, much larger than it actually is. And of course then there is the representation of people who get involved in these kind of activities as irrational. You can't negotiate with them, they're ruthless, they're mentally ill in some instances, some of the literature would hold, they're inhuman, and they're not amenable to negotiation. And again, the work of John Horgan, for example, would indicate that none of these actually can be evidence does not support this. And finally, I think quite a lot of the literature, and indeed some of the people who are activist practitioners in the area, is that the way to counter terrorism is by being tough on terrorism and by using physical force and military means. And I think many people, even in the orthodox field, would have a problem with this view that actually the use of physical force is making the problem worse rather than better. Not to say that it isn't necessary sometimes, but that it's not the be-all and end-all. So that's the problem that, or some of the problems that occur throughout thinking about terrorism. And so the critical turn that we're interested in promoting suggests a number of directions that we might take. The first I've referred to already, making the citizen, not the state, the entity that needs to be secured. So security becomes the securing of citizens, not the securing of the state. And that has great significance, and hopefully that will become clear as I talk on. States and sub-state actors both use terror, and I've spoken about that. Terror is also often driven by grievances, and that actually recognizing this and negotiating and addressing these grievances is an effective way of ending terror and the support for terror. Force-based counter-terrorist measures often have a symbiotic relationship with terrorism. We can learn from the past in terms of previous experiences in places such as Latin America, South Africa, Northern Ireland, and elsewhere. And we ought to resist Manichaean analysis, very bifurcated black and white thinking about this, even though the pressure is on us to think in those terms when faced with violence. And finally, and I think probably most importantly, we need to slightly be aware of experts. And I'm in a bit of a quandary standing up in front of you, supposedly an expert on this subject. By that I mean, I certainly claim to know about Northern Ireland. And that's a very specific, grounded expertise, if you want to call it that, based in the context of the politics and the local conditions that pertain in that area. I think to claim expertise on terrorism in general, however, is a bit of a tall order. And I think, as Martha Crenshaw has argued, the context is so important in actually understanding the specific conditions under which actors take action that really we need to just be very careful that there isn't a good area studies and input to any particular account of terrorism. I want to now turn to Paddy Hilliard's ideas about the suspect community. And Paddy Hilliard, writing in 1993 about the Prevention of Terrorism Acts and their operation in the UK, argues, he's using a quote from a judgment. I can't remember the name of the judge, actually, but there we are. The judgment says, an officer has to satisfy himself of the only matter upon which he must be satisfied, namely that the person whom he seeks to examine is, and this is my emphasis, in the category of person where he can say to himself that he is suspected. He does not have to have any grounds for thinking that they would have that information, but merely that the person concerned is in a category, which in his view makes it reasonable that he should find out and that he should ask questions. Now, I am emphasising this notion of a person being in a category, because Hilliard then goes on to argue that the Prevention of Terrorism Acts in the UK operated in a particularly problematic way. In other words, it is lawful for examining officers to stop and examine someone simply because they are Irish. This is a much more insidious power than one which permits only random investigations. Under a system of random investigations, in theory, at least everyone has an equal chance of being stopped. This, after all, is the meaning of random. So Hilliard is arguing that the Prevention of Terrorism Acts in the 1980s, the departure from the ordinary law of suspicion and stopping somebody on the basis of suspicion, namely that they've been involved in an act or commissioning an act, that the departure from that and the allowing of stopping people in a category was the beginning of the creation of a suspect community. And here's what Hilliard has to say. He says, a person who's drawn into the criminal justice system under the PTA is not a suspect in the normal sense of the word. They are not believed to be involved in or guilty of some illegal act. People are suspect primarily because they are Irish, and once they're in the police station, they're often labelled an Irish suspect, presumably as some part of some classification system. In practice, they are being held because they belong to a suspect community. So here we have a situation where the law itself has created, and we Hilliard goes on to talk about how the police then will justify these methods because it is assumed everybody in the IRA is Irish, and it is assumed the IRA uses threats to enforce cooperation and law-abiding members of that community. It is therefore sound policing practice to interview people with Irish connections. However, according to Hilliard's analysis, a second problem associated with viewing the whole Irish community as a suspect is that the public, the general public, is encouraged to do the same thing. And he cites a piece from the Mail on Sunday, which quotes a deputy assistant commissioner of the police who's reported to have said, "We need the public to tell us all about the Irish people who have arrived within the last year or so. They may be living with you or near you or working with you. Just tell us and we'll check it out." Okay. I think I've made my point. This is a cartoon from the Evening Standard in 1982, which depicts the kind of atmosphere that pertained in this country at that time. There was a bit of a hoo-ha about this particular cartoon, but nonetheless you can see that the Irish are depicted in the ultimate psychopathic horror, and the show features the IRA, the NLA, the UDF, which actually I think they mean the UVF and so on. Anyway. And now I want to quote from myself. This is something that I wrote when I was thinking about suspect communities. I'm in a restaurant in South London in 1976 with an English colleague and his wife from the hospital in which I'm an intern. They are asking me about life in Northern Ireland. My accent identifies me as from Northern Ireland, and we notice a group of men who've been drinking at the bar who've been eavesdropping on our conversation. They approach our table, they surround us, talking about how blood will flow in the streets of Northern Ireland when our boys are permitted to do what should be done there. I go to the bar to pay the bill, as it is clear we must leave. I realise I cannot call the police because it is me who will be arrested, not them, even if the barman would allow me to use the phone, which seems unlikely given his attitude, which implies that I have caused the trouble. We leave. They follow us out onto the street. They swing punches at us. We run. We escape, with them yelling abuse at us, terrorist scum, paddy bastards, and so on. By the way, I was the only Irish person there. The other two people were English. So that's my experience. I'd like to also give another example, a much more serious example, the case of Harry Stanley, who was a Scottish man living here in London. He had just got out of hospital with colon cancer when he was shot dead by the police. He was coming home from the pub carrying a chair leg, which his brother had repaired for him, and he was planning to put back on the table from whence it had come. And the police shouted and challenged him. He replied in a Scottish accent. The police officer shot him, thinking it was a Northern Ireland accent, and he was dealing with an armed Irishman. And this happened here in this city. And another example in the present day. in September the 8th, 2006, an 11-year-old girl called Sundas Al-Amin was called an Iraqi suicide bomber at Nottingham Manning Comprehensive Girls' School. She did not report it. 2 hours later, the same white girl with a gang of eight others verbally abused Sundas, who then told the head teacher, Leslie Lyon, to complain to her and was told to come back if it happened again. It happened again at 1:15, and the same girl screamed at Sundas, "Help, help, suicide bomber," and ran away. This time Sundas complained to the other head teacher, who promised Sundas that she would look into the matter. However, her father asserts that nothing was done. So I'm making a parallel here between my own experience, the experience of Harry Stanley, and the experience of Sundas. And again, this is from a Canadian newspaper recently. And finally, I'd like to give the example of Kazim Ali, who is a poet, was teaching in a university in the United States, and he had marked a large amount of poetry assignments, and he had a box of them, and he left them at a trash can outside his office building because they were for recycling. A man in an adjoining building saw him do this and called the campus police, saying that a man of Middle Eastern appearance driving a car with out-of-state plates and with no campus parking sticker had just left a box near the trash can. The campus was closed down, the buildings were evacuated, classes were cancelled, and so on and so forth. And I don't have time to go into what Kazim Ali said about this, but basically he says, "I'm a threat by my very existence, a threat just living in the world as a Muslim body. That man in the parking lot didn't even see me. He saw my darkness. He saw my Middle Eastern descent. Ironic, because although my grandfathers came from Egypt, I'm Indian. He wasn't even from the Middle East." So basically, I'm creating an argument here, which is to say that the suspect community, as a concept, is a product of the securitized imagination. We don't necessarily look at people and see them for what they are. We see them for what we think they are. And this is informed by the insecure society that we live in at the moment. And if we just think about some of the things that are in the newspapers and the media that make us feel insecure and endangered, we can list a whole raft of things, from swine flu to obesity to heart disease to national debt and on and on. And terrorism is right in there as well. So the atmosphere of fear that's promulgated, and then along comes terrorism as the fear par excellence and making us feel endangered. And of course we turn to the source of the threat, which is the suspect community, which I'm arguing is not a real community. The English people who were with me in that restaurant in South London were not members of the Irish community. Kazim Ali is not from the Middle East, and so on and so forth. This is an imagined community. It's a phantom community. And therefore, I think we need to be very careful about basing security practices on this kind of process. Had I time, I was going to go on and talk about how the concept of security itself has been based on the construction of an other, and how that other then becomes the suspect community, and how dangerous that is when you place that set of security practices in a society where we already have racism and Islamophobia, and the two things getting mixed up with one another in a very dangerous cocktail, it seems to me. And I could speak a little bit more about policing practices, had I time, and the concerns that have been raised recently about not only the operation of Stop and Search, and this is from The Times last week, where the latest statistics show that, in fact, there is not an equal opportunity to be stopped and searched by the police, that there is targeting, that people do, who walk around in their daily lives as people of colour, have much more chance of being stopped and searched than people who are white like me. And of course, we, the Irish, are now off the hook these days, more or less, on that score. And this, I think, is the argument is basically one where surveillance, and we have now got the recruitment of 60,000 citizens to assist the police in spying on their neighbours, it seems to me, and that kind of atmosphere of fear being one which is dangerous for civil liberties in general. At worst, members of suspect communities are dehumanised and become targets of racial abuse and xenophobic attack, and I don't think we need to encourage that kind of development. I'm actually going to skip very quickly because there's one quite important thing that I want to say in relation to suspect communities themselves. Because, of course, as a member of a suspect community, I was, and British Muslims nowadays are, citizens of this society and entitled to expect their security to be taken care of in the same way as any other citizen. But, of course, that isn't necessarily the case. Iranian comedian, Maz Jobrani, whom those of you who look at YouTube may want to check out, actually does a humorous depiction of the dilemma he finds himself going through airports and so on as an Iranian, Iraqi. But he also makes a very important point in a humorous way about his own security. He says, you see, I'm a citizen. I'm scared of Al-Qaeda just like everybody else. But I've got to worry, on top of being scared of Al-Qaeda, I've got to worry about being profiled as Al-Qaeda as well. So it's not so much that I, as a former member of a suspect community being from Northern Ireland, had to worry about the threats to my life as well as the threats from the security forces and being stopped and held on occasions for 8 hours by the security forces, travelling in and out of this country, being stopped at airports, and all of the things that happen to suspect communities. And of course, this is a problem because people in suspect communities are the very people we have to rely on in terms of making sure that all of us are safe, because people in suspect communities do know more and are closer to the source of threat, where the threat is in this instance the IRA or loyalist paramilitaries or people who are taking up violence for Islamist causes. I've run out of time, so I'm actually going to stop with that horrible image. Let me just finish by making one last point. I'm arguing that the creation of the suspect community is the first of a number of steps, because by creating a suspect community, we enable certain security practices, such as detention without trial, the targeting of certain communities, the derogation from certain principles of human rights. And that is a downward slippery slope, as it were, because torture can't be practiced without extraordinary rendition. Rendition can't be practiced without suspect communities. It's a first stage in a targeting, and it's one in which the general public have been made complicit by the way in which these issues are represented in the media. I'm sorry I've run out of time. I can commend to you that our new journal, there's leaflets out there if you want to have a look, and a book which I will leave with Elizabeth. Thank you.
Okay, and our final speaker on this panel is Zachary Katz-Nelson from the organisation REPREVE.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm going to speak a bit about my experience working with prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. And I just came back from there about 2 weeks ago, and I've been there probably about a dozen times now over the last 4 years. And also talk to you about some of their personal stories, about what they've gone through. They're kind of the human face of this debate. People who've been in prison now for 7 years, who've been subject to extraordinary rendition, who've been subject to torture, some of whom may have done certain things, some of whom did not. And where do they fit in this discussion of deliberative processes and the issues of fear and of the societal context in which we're dealing with terrorism? And I think just to pick up on the points that have been made already, this really is about fear, but it's also about anger. And I'll speak a lot about the United States perspective because I think, obviously, that's my experience as an American, but also because it's the system I've been dealing with. But because the United States undoubtedly sets an example for the rest of the world. And if you look at what has been done since September 11th and how rendition has picked up, how extraordinary rendition has picked up, how disappearances have multiplied across the globe by various governments, for instance, in Pakistan, where now thousands of people over the last several years have just disappeared at the hands of the security services. Time and again, they justify their actions by pointing to the United States. The United States sets the gold standard for human rights, sets the gold standard for how you treat people in terrorism contexts and otherwise. And the United States, under George Bush certainly, and continuing someone under Barack Obama, has said it's okay to do these things. So it's critical that we focus on what the United States has done, not in a vacuum, not alone, but as the vanguard in this fight, and whether or not it's the proper way to go about it. But just to backtrack a bit, it's fear, and specifically in an American way, it's anger that has motivated so much of what is going on. And, you know, in the United States, we're taught growing up, and this is shown in kind of how we're taught about history, about wars, about America as being the divine right from God, that we have the right to settle the land that is the United States. That if you come after us, if you try and attack us, we will destroy you. We will absolutely destroy you. That there is no might greater than the United States of America, and that God is on our side. Whether that's a Christian God or a Jewish God or a Muslim God, God is on our side, and we are right. And that's what you're taught growing up. And so then, comes September 11th, and while there is talk of, is this new terrorism at all? Is this something different? For us, it was. For most people, this was the first time they'd ever experienced an attack on their own soil. And it was Oklahoma City in the mid-1990s, where an American attacked other Americans. Over 150 people died. But this was slightly different, and it was on a catastrophic scale. And it terrorized all of us. It really scared us. And it made us furious. And so we were faced with the choice of how to react to this. Do we lash out? Or do we take a step back and think about all the reasons about why things happen, about ways to attack this, ways to deal with the problem? And we chose only the former. And it's gotten us to where we are today. Fast forward to now. And you have this ongoing debate in the United States about Guantanamo Bay. Do we actually close it? Now, President Obama has said he will. He's ordered that it must. And the Republicans are ramping up the rhetoric that this will bring terrorists into our community, for instance, if people are brought to the United States to stand trial or for indefinite detention, and that this will make us all less safe. There will be another September 11th because we are closing Guantanamo, and that no matter what has been done to individuals, no matter what torture may have been perpetrated, no matter how long people were disappeared from their families, look at the result. Has there been another September 11th? Have we been attacked again? No, we haven't. If you look at the world in one particular way, there hasn't been a domestic attack on U.S. soil. But if you look at the radicalization of many communities around the world, we have been, and we have lost countless lives. U.S. soldiers in Iraq, for instance, U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, civilians, obviously, around the world who've been caught up in these conflicts. And for every person that's in Guantanamo Bay, and there are 240 people who are there now, if you ask U.S. intelligence officials, police, counterterrorism officials, how many people around the world now, for every one person in Guantanamo, has been radicalized, is willing to take up arms, is willing to do violence, and now has bought into the rhetoric of hate against the United States? Some people will say 10, some people will say a dozen, some people will say 100. But there's no question that it is the greatest recruiting tool that terrorists have out there in the world right now. It's what the United States has done, places like Abu Ghraib, places like Guantanamo. And very shortly, there will be more pictures released of U.S. abuses, within the next couple weeks, you will see things start to hit the airwaves. In Guantanamo Bay, in secret prisons around the world, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And you'll see more. Some maybe not as bad as Abu Ghraib, some worse in different ways. And it will start this debate again. But always the touchstone in the United States is September 11th. And I'll give you an example. Of the roughly 800 people that have passed through Guantanamo at some point, six are alleged to have a connection with September 11th. Six people out of almost 800. And yet it defines everything that happens there. And it defines virtually all of U.S. policy. When a soldier finishes his tour of duty in Guantanamo Bay after 1 year, he gets a memento, an American flag that is run up the main flagpole in the prison, that he gets to keep it to honor his service. And how long do they keep it up there for? 9 minutes and 11 seconds to honor September 11th victims. It defines everything. And it's about six people who are there. And so we have to step back, but in the United States, that's virtually impossible in the current political climate. Because not only is there this rhetoric of fear in the media and whatnot, but it's the chosen right now, the number one arrow in the arsenal of the Republican Party in trying to attack Barack Obama. Because nothing else is gaining traction. They ran on a rhetoric of fear in 2002, they won. They ran on a rhetoric of fear in 2004, and they won again. 2006, they started to lose traction. 2008, they lost even more. But now they're trying again. And with the closing of Guantanamo, they've chosen to attack this issue once more. And it is the politicians that are stirring this up. And Democrats are not immune to it either. Just this week, they canceled $80 million in funding that Barack Obama had asked for to specifically close Guantanamo Bay. The Democrats did that, not the Republicans. And so there are three choices that were laid out by my colleague before for people in Guantanamo. You let them go, you put them on trial, or you just continue to hold them. And I think there's the legal debate about what can be done under American law. There's no question, under American law right now, you cannot indefinitely detain somebody. It's simply illegal. It's simply against the U.S. Constitution, and there's no way around that. But in the political climate, is there a choice? But the other issue, besides the legal question, is the image that's projected to the world. And that's the bigger thing here, I say. It's not about the legal debates, it's not about the legal niceties. It's that you have the last 8 years as a backdrop, and Obama has to send a different message to the world, otherwise the radicalization and the divergence of views and the violence continues. And that's what he's been trying to do. The question is if he'll be allowed to succeed or if he chooses to take a different path. He's talked lately, for instance, about reviving military commissions. So you guys may be familiar with these in Guantanamo. It's the idea that a civilian court can't handle terrorism cases. That there's certain evidence that wouldn't be admitted in a civilian court because it'll be gained from torture. And I think just as a quick aside, if there's any question about whether or not torture has been perpetrated, Dick Cheney referred to waterboarding, which is one of the more excruciating, terrifying experiences you can go through. It's where you're strapped to a board, your head is lower than your feet, cloth is placed over your face, you're completely immobilized, strapped down, and water is slowly poured over your nose, in your mouth, and slowly comes down and starts to fill your lungs. And because you're pitched back, and because this cloth is on your face, you can't cough it out. You can't do anything at all. And you feel like you're drowning. It's the exact same sensation as what happens when you drown. Exactly the same. And it causes searing pain inside. You think you're going to die. Now, the U.S. has done this time and again against terrorism suspects. Dick Cheney called it a dunk in the water. But if you look at history, and we talk about new terrorism, we say we don't learn from the past. In this case, we did learn from the past, but we learned in the reverse. So the United States itself has prosecuted people for waterboarding. Everybody from a sheriff in Texas, 1920s, who had waterboarded with his deputies as suspects, they were all sent to prison. To Japanese soldiers who had done it to Americans who were caught as prisoners of war during World War II, they were brought up on war crimes charges and prosecuted for waterboarding after World War II. We have now adopted this technique. You look at a lot of the techniques that the U.S. has chosen to use against people in the aim of getting information, and they all learn from history. They were taught to U.S. soldiers and intelligence operatives as to prepare them for torture. That was the word that was used by the U.S. government. Things that will break you mentally and physically. And for most people, it's the mental that will get you more than anything. You heard recent reports, there was a Red Cross report recently released about what the CIA did to folks like Abu Zubaydah, who was supposedly a high-level al-Qaeda operative. And what they brought in psychologists and psychiatrists to try and find what the specific personal fears were of him. So each of you think for a second about what kind of that dark place you don't want to go to is. For me, it's close, hot, confined spaces. They would find that, and they would use it. For him, it was close, confined spaces, but it was also insects. As they put him in a room full of insects, not because they were going to hurt him, because it was going to utterly terrify him. And it did. And he began to talk. And so do we get the results that we want? Are we all more safe because of that? Dick Cheney says yes. I've seen a lot of secret evidence in these cases, in the Guantanamo cases. I've worked on more than 50 cases. I've seen both the secret and the open evidence. I have yet to see any evidence of a terrorist plot been revealed, then attacked by law enforcement and brought down. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, but no one has shown me any evidence that it works. It's a debate for another day, perhaps. Rendition. We've learned from history there, too. Rendition was not a new technique by George Bush. Rendition has existed for a long time, but President Reagan and then President Clinton ramped it up considerably. In fact, under President Clinton, the CIA set up an entire office dedicated solely to extraordinary rendition. This is where you go in and you basically kidnap somebody and turn them over to another government. Sometimes it's the United States government. Sometimes it's to another government like Egypt, because you want information or you want to put them on trial, or both. Now, it's been practiced historically. Adolf Eichmann was grabbed off the street in Buenos Aires, early 1960s, by Israeli agents in a practice that was copied virtually exactly by the CIA. Men come up in face masks, dressed in black, grab someone off the street, throw him into a van, drug him, take him to an undisclosed location, bundle him up in diapers, in shackles, throw him on a plane, and take him somewhere around the world. That's what the Israelis did to Eichmann. That's exactly what the U.S. government does now. When Israel did it, they were hailed as heroes. They had brought someone to justice who had evaded the courts, who had evaded law enforcement, who had the protection of Argentina for a long time. Heroic. Fast forward to Italy. After September 11th, the CIA grabs cleric there off the streets, kidnaps him, black vans drive up, grab him off the streets, just like out of the movies. It's exactly how Hollywood would do it, but it's what they do. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Rendition, which came out a little while ago. Not the greatest film ever made, but true to form. What's pictured there is real. It's what my clients have gone through. One of my clients, Saifullah Paracha, he's now 62 years old. He's from Pakistan. He was grabbed at a Bangkok airport. He had gotten off a flight from Pakistan. Called his family right when he was getting on the plane, said, "I love you, I'll call you when I get there." They never heard from him again. Just like in the movie Rendition, he's walking through to try and get to Customs and Immigration. Some agents come up to him and say, "Can you please come with me, sir?" And he's disappeared. He was sent to a secret prison in Afghanistan for a year. Today he's in Guantanamo Bay. Now, in the past, by traditional law enforcement measures, you ask Pakistan to turn somebody over if you want them. And then the question is, what if Pakistan doesn't respond? What if they don't want to give you somebody? I suppose the most egregious example of this is Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden. What do you do then? Do you throw away the law, or do you go in and kidnap them? And then what do you do once you have them? I'm posing questions. My answer is that kidnapping is not correct, but I think it's important to pose the questions, because these are the questions that are posed in the political debate, and these are the questions that are given the context of rhetoric, of fear and anger, are easy answers for most people. You grab them, you kidnap them, you do whatever is necessary. The rule of law be damned. And the real question is, once we start that path, what is the limiting principle? And I think that's the real problem here, is that you can always justify making exceptions to the rules by emergent circumstances. But what's the limiting principle? So my client's in Guantanamo Bay. I'll give you an example. Mohammed Al-Gharani, who was 14 years old when he was picked up, after he arrived in Guantanamo, a prisoner told the United States Mohammed Al-Gharani was part of an Al-Qaeda cell in London in 1998. It's pretty scary. Maybe it was an Al-Qaeda cell in London in 1998. It's before a lot of us were even aware of Al-Qaeda. Now, Mohammed, incidentally, was 11 in 1998 and had never left Saudi Arabia, where he was born and raised. So there's that one obvious fact that maybe the information you've got is wrong, that there's almost no way physically this could happen. He didn't speak English either, by the way. No evidence he'd ever been to London, no evidence he'd ever left Saudi Arabia, but somebody said it was possible. So fear and anger kick in, and what do they start to do? They start to subject Muhammad to what's called the frequent flyer program. It's a sleep deprivation program where every 2 to 3 hours they move you to a new cell. Not for a day or two, but for 3 weeks. So you don't sleep properly for 3 weeks. It destroys your mind. You can't think straight. You can't function. Your body goes into shock. Everything breaks down. Absolutely everything breaks down if you don't have sleep. And they did this to try and get information from him. He kept repeating the same thing. "I don't know what you are talking about." He never gave information about it. He didn't have anything to give. It's interesting, this is a case where they essentially tortured somebody and he didn't break in the way that they hoped. He didn't give them the information they wanted. Yet, when we finally got to court this past year in his case, after the U.S. Supreme Court said, "You have the right to challenge your detention. You have the right to say to the government, do you actually have any proof?" The government raised this yet again as a reason to justify keeping him in prison. It was one of the things they trotted out to a federal judge saying, "You got to keep him in there. He might have been part of an Al-Qaeda cell in London in 1998. Now, fortunately, on one level, the judge rejected that, and he ordered that Muhammad go free. Said there was not reliable information that he was a member of an Al-Qaeda cell, or frankly the other accusations they had against him, which were based on information from the same source who had said he was in an Al-Qaeda cell, and from one other prisoner who had also been proven to be a liar. However, Muhammad is still there today. We won his case in January. He's still in prison. And that's where the difficulties come in, because now the United States, even though there's a court ruling that says Muhammad should go free, even though there's a court ruling that says Muhammad is not a terrorist, that he did not have connections with terrorism, When the United States now talks to his home country to get him back, they're imposing increasingly onerous conditions. He has to be watched 24 hours a day. He has to let them know his movements at all times. He can't travel outside the country. And his home country, which actually he's a citizen of Chad, though he grew up in Saudi Arabia, is somewhat understandably balking at this. And because of this diplomatic tussle, he sits in prison. And his should be an easy case. His is a case of someone who, he went through the court system. The court looked at all the evidence, secret and open. There was nothing that was withheld from the court because it was top secret or too secret. There was not the same kind of torture evidence in other cases. And the court said he should go free. And it hasn't worked. It just hasn't worked at all. He's actually in isolation right now. He's in a block of cells with only one other prisoner. He's been beaten and pepper sprayed within the past week. Should be a free man. It's the human cost of the fear, the rhetoric, the anger. And the end result, somebody spent a third of their life in prison, never should have been there in the first place. Just some food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all three speakers. We've got about 15 minutes for questions before we break. So if I could ask people just to raise their hands. Yep, we have one here.
Yep. Hello. My name is Guy Fitzmaurice. My question's for Fiona, really. I was interested in your talk, but it seems to me that any rule of law approach at looking at necessity for detention without charge needs to look at necessity and proportionality. And it's never been demonstrated to me why there's any necessity to detain people without charge. If there's evidence, they should be charged. If there isn't, they shouldn't be. Both the ex-DPP and the ex-head of MI5 have said that detention without charge for months is unnecessary. And I don't know if people are aware the threshold for being charged in this country is very low. All the state needs is a reasonable suspicion that somebody has committed an offence, and there's an expectation that there will be further evidence with which they can be convicted. So are we saying that it's okay to lock people up for 6 months when there's not even a reasonable suspicion that they've committed an offence?
I think that your point about necessity and proportionality is very important and well made. And in my view, the arguments about necessity are part of the justificatory process. That is why that is so important, that a state can't just say, we have to detain people without trial or charge, they're dangerous people, without somebody saying, well, if they're dangerous, charge them. As you say, the threshold is quite low for charging.
If there's evidence, they should be charged.
Well, sometimes there may be. This is a question about risk. And actually, this, when Marie gave her example of having a greater risk of being knocked down by a car than being subject, than being killed by terrorist activity. I mean, for me, the question is not the level of risk, but the question of risk management. How can that risk be managed? So you may have some evidence that is not enough for reasonable suspicion, but the only way of risk managing is detention while you're gathering evidence. Now, if you have detention that has reasonable, that has meaningful processes, the likelihood for the kind of abuse that has happened in the war on terrorism reduces. So I think that necessity has to be made out generally for the process or for the system, but also individually for individual people. But I think that it would actually, if you had a proper process-based system, be incredibly rare that you would have to detain somebody without charge or trial at all. And once you're charged, then bail processes start, and of course there are arguments against giving bail in advance of the trial. So I think that proportionality is a design question that comes in that initial deliberative process as well. I really think that that is key to developing
systems. Can I come back very quickly? I think the problem with that argument is that the evil that you're creating is worse than the evil that you're seeking to attract. Because the risk is so low. You know, gets head of MI5 and says we don't need detention without charge.
Did he say we never need? I mean, I'm not.
He said we don't need it for months and months. I mean, clearly at the moment, it's not. I think a month is enough.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, a stopwatch approach to your approach to a judge, to the time which you brought before a judge, where the state has to make out a case there, I think that that addresses that. So, I mean, I think you can have detention without charge or trial. It doesn't necessarily go on and on. And as I said, the reason why I think it is now probable that some people in Guantanamo Bay will be detained indefinitely without charge is because the system was illegitimate, which allowed for abuses that created that inevitability.
Marie wanted to come in briefly on that, and now I have another.
Yeah, just very briefly, I mean, I have two other concerns about this. I mean, the first one is, you know, where you do introduce legislation, counter-terrorist legislation in general, there tends to be, and there has been in recent times, a kind of mission creep where it becomes applied for purposes other than for countering terrorism. The case that springs to mind is the NatWest 3 who extradited to the United States on grounds of terrorism when actually they were not terrorists. The second problem, I think, is the culture of the security forces. I used to work in Northern Ireland post the Good Friday Agreement on the issue of the reform of the criminal justice system. And where you allow derogation from good standards of law and due process, you create a culture within the judiciary, within the police, and within the apparatus of the criminal justice system that is extremely dangerous indeed. And I think this is really very troublesome and very, very difficult to reverse. And I think, therefore, we need to be very careful indeed in terms of allowing people to practice the law on behalf of all of us in ways that actually cut corners and stand down from standards that have been established over time.
Hi, I'm Garvin Walsh. This is a question for Marie. It's about the nature of suspect communities. Sort of based on two stories. One was that 90 years ago, my grandmother's house was raided by the Black and Tans, and my great grandfather's revolutionary papers were hidden in her nappy. Now, in that occasion, the Black and Tans actually behaved reasonably. They didn't abuse anyone. They actually had correct intelligence because my great-grandfather was taking part in the War of Independence. But three generations down, it's still told in my family as a story of British oppression. And so it's something that from the perspective of the state could be seen as reasonable, but from the perspective of the insurgents was seen as oppressive. And so you have two different sort of constructions of a suspect community going on. Second example is my own. I used to advise the Conservative Party on national security policy. And a couple of years ago, we produced a report concerning the way the government was, we believed, elevating the importance of some non-violent Islamists in the UK as part of their counter-terrorism strategy. And we believed that this had the effect of increasing their profile, and the effect of this was to make many non-Muslims in Britain think that these extremists actually represented a Muslim community that didn't hold such extreme views. Now, these organizations like to call themselves Muslim this and Islamic that. So when we actually raised this issue and published the report, Newsnight ran a piece saying the Conservatives have named the following organizations, and they started listing Muslim this and Islamic that, as organizations that the government shouldn't be talking to. Now, the effect of this was actually to increase feeling in among Muslims that the Conservative Party was seeing them all as kind of a suspect community, which wasn't the intended result. And I suppose what I'm asking for is how, if you are trying to make political decisions in this environment, how you try and reduce the risk of strengthening a feeling among a suspect community or among members attributed to that suspect community that they are under suspicion when you're trying to do the opposite.
Oh, Okay, well, how long have I got?
2 minutes.
It's difficult for me to answer how you do it properly when all of my experience has been of not doing it well. And I think that, unfortunately, continues in the present day. I mean, we have the recent example of the Home Secretary refusing to talk to the Muslim Council of Britain because their deputy chair went to the meeting in Turkey, and the meeting in Turkey condemned the action in Gaza and so on. So, no, I understand that. Yeah. Well, I understand that, but my point is simply this: irrespective of what the meeting in Turkey has said, no harm, in my view, comes from talking to people. I think the harm comes in stopping talking to people, in isolating them, in making them feel even more aggrieved than they were to begin with. And indeed, the lessons of recent history in Northern Ireland shows quite clearly that talking to people, even as they are actively involved in violence, is the way forward in terms of ending that violence. So I think, you know, that from my point of view, there are lessons to be drawn in terms of isolating people and punishing them for holding views which you may disagree with is certainly not the way forward. I think isolation is dangerous. I think standing down from the rule of law is dangerous. And I think pointing to certain suspect groups and isolating them is certainly not the way forward. As I say, it's very difficult for me to sit here in 2 seconds and respond in a more considered way, because actually that work has not been done, but we certainly know what not to do. My difficulty, and the story I told about being in the restaurant in London, the troubling part of that story, from your point of view, is that I couldn't call the police. Now, that is, and I'm not making that up, and I went to work in the reform of the criminal justice system in Northern Ireland with a heavy heart, because actually, you know, all of my experience taught me that these people were not there to protect me, and I made a political decision that I had to contribute to turning that around. Now, that is a major political problem. It's also a problem for law and order, and it's not unique to Northern Ireland. It's a problem that faces this country, not just, by the way, with Muslims, but with young blacks and with various other parts of the community who feel that alienation. And I think it's a problem for a democratic country to grasp, and it's not the responsibility simply of people who are dealing with terrorism, but a much more broad problem of law and order.
We have one other question.
I'm Cynthia Patrick. I'm the new Director of Policy for Conciliation Resources, and I've spent the past 4 years in Lebanon, where I was managing a center for victims of torture. I want to say how much I've enjoyed all 3 lectures. And I wanted to make 2 comments. One of them is about the longer-term negative effects of some of the policies you have described. Because in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, what you have described, for example, the tortures in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib, this is what their governments are doing to their citizens. So for an Arab or for a Muslim, this is rather something normal when done by the governments. But what is more dangerous is when countries who preach democracy and human rights, which are already a bit seen as suspicious values because they come from the West, but when these democracies use the same methods, then for the population it's, oh, okay, it was just words. They are like us. They are, and I think it undermines these values for a much longer time, and this is a very, very, apart from the sufferings for the individuals, but there's a much longer term negative effect in spreading the belief that these values don't really exist, even in the Western world. And the other thing I wanted to say is about non-violent Islam. After this intervention, I've also done a research recently in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon on pacifist Islamic movements. And they do exist. But I want to say that it's it's a delicate topic, and you cannot act, we say in French, comme un éléphant dans un magasin de porcelaine, like an elephant in a china shop. I think you have a similar example. So you cannot stigmatize people for 50 years and then say, oh, we will do a report and we are going to fix it. Because it's dangerous even for these people, because they are on a very delicate pattern here in countries where violence, oppression, occupation still exist. Nonviolence is a difficult path, and it requires a lot of thinking before engaging. I agree we should, dialogue is always the best option, but before showing support from a political party or from a country, it requires a bit more thinking, because it can expose these people who are doing a very delicate work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could I just perhaps invite each speaker very briefly to say anything they'd like to say in response to close the session?
Sure. I think that I just wanted to respond to the very last comment, actually, because I think it sums up, or it leads us to think of one of the really important things, and that is value leakage. We talk a lot in human rights law about kind of horizontal norm transfer, and we normally talk about it as a very positive thing, you know, transferring positive human rights protection norms from state to state. The danger is the negative norm transfer that has absolutely manifested itself. I thought, Zachary, you know, there's a great example of Pakistan. A few years ago, I was over in Peshawar, as some of you may know, was right up by the northwest, up in the northwest frontier province, and it was quite common knowledge that the ISI would just pick people up and they would disappear, that there were black sites everywhere, and that was not only endorsed but almost encouraged by Western powers. So one of the things that President Obama has to do if he wants to prevent negative norm leakage and he wants to re-establish the city on the hill idea is he has to prosecute people within the United States administration who sanctioned and carried out torture. And he is being incredibly reluctant to do that. He pretty seems that he may prosecute some lawyers who advised on torture, but he does not seem willing to prosecute people who carried torture out or ordered it. And in my view, that is absolutely the first step, not only in the US, but also in states in Europe that had secret prisons, and even states like Ireland that may have colluded in extraordinary rendition, if that is proven. That there has to be strong action condemning that, to make a clean break, if you can, and try to reverse the negative norm transfer.
I'll respond in part to the first question. And I agree that in some ways the only way we're ever going to learn from history is to expose it, let people know what it was, and you do have to punish some wrongdoers, otherwise folks aren't going to take the consequences seriously. But in terms of the detention without trial, the reason this is even part of the debate is that this is a problem essentially of the Bush government's own creation, that if you torture people enough and you get evidence from them, and the question is, well, can you use evidence based on torture in court? The answer is no. And so that's all we've got against some people. So if they had gone about it with proper tactics, with traditional forms of interrogation, for instance, there would be so-called clean evidence that would be easy to use to get prosecutions against people. The evidence would exist. There is still some evidence that exists against people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for instance, supposedly the mastermind of September 11th. He's admitted it many times, but he admitted it even before he was in U.S. custody. And so you could use that so-called clean evidence against him. There's no need to create this new security apparatus, this new type of court that allows in torture evidence, for instance. There's no need for the alternative of indefinite detention. But for some people, you don't have that so-called clean evidence. And it's a problem the administration has created. It's a limited problem, a limited number of people, and yet there's a possibility of creating a whole new system that could then be used against countless others. And I think that's the real problem, is legislation by anecdote and creation of an entire system based on a couple stories.
And I'd just like to finish by calling for a redefinition of security to include the security of all of us, including people who are held in Guantanamo Bay without any evidence against them and should be not held there and are innocent people, those people's security is as important as my security or anybody else's. And to derogate from that standard creates danger for all of us. And I'd just like to finish there. Thanks.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank very much all three speakers for starting off the conference so well and the questions as well. I'm sure we'll keep on talking about these themes for the rest of the day. Thank you.